From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I can't think of anybody who moves as gracefully from stage to film to television as my guest, Stockard Channing, who hasn't been here since 2002 with The Business of Strangers. So it's good to have her back here. First time I remember seeing you really was in a hot tub with Garrett Graham with him going, "It really cooks, baby," in that TV show you did in the 70s.
The Stockard Channing show.
Yes. You moved
the
on.
The font alone of that title is pretty much locked in time for me.
But you're not locked in time. You moved on. I saw you on stage in A Day in the Death of Joe Egg, currently starring in John Robin Bates' play Other Desert Cities, for which you're nominated for yet another Tony Award. It's so good to have you back.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
But talk to me about you playing these women for whom language can be kind of a weapon and also a way to delude themselves. I mean, there's always a subtext in terms of the character's relationship to language, and that's really very present for Polly in Other Desert Cities.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, it's true of the whole family. There's five of us. We consider ourselves a quintet because we really like play different vocal instruments, if you will.
Sure.
And I think that keeps the audience going. And Polly's a very specific instrument. But because, you know, basically Robbie said we rehearsal, you know, no, this is actually nothing happens in this play. Well, but it's all about the interaction between these characters. It's conversation. Then something very large is revealed at the end. It's the process of the evening. There is a certain amount of disintegration and stuff. But to keep an audience listening to the music, if you will, I think you've got to be very much aware of who you are and how you speak as individuals. You don't pick up each other's rhythms, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
And but for Polly, who is a whole family, is, as I said, a very verbal family. They're all writers. They're all creators. And we learned that she is sitting on a secret. And someone said to me that this character is someone who's been holding a beach ball under the water for 25 years. And Robbie once said that this play is about the toll keeping a secret takes, a toll on the living human being, not being found out, not being caught for anything bad or revealing something good, but the toll of keeping something hidden for 25 years in a family. So she, her outward affect is actually quite different from the woman we find out that lives inside that casing, if you will. Now, that's me saying, I hope you agree with it. You saw it. I didn't see it.
I would, but I also, because as you were talking, and we should say it takes place during the holidays of family in Palm Springs, mm-hmm. which there is a kind of intersection between the personal and the political, and I don't want to say any more than that because I don't want to give away too much. But there's this relationship to truth mm-hmm. that your characters, you had, and I thought about this falling in line with Joe Egg and Six Degrees of Separation and House of Blue Leaves. So some of these characters you played have a very interesting sort of relationship with the truth and what they know to be the truth and how much of that truth they want to reveal to people.
Well, if you start with Joe Egg, that's someone who keeps himself alive by self-delusion to a degree,
sure.
a hope. And then we go to Weeza Kittredge in Six Degrees. I think that she is somebody who's transformed by experience. I always think it's like a little book building, if you will, for Weeza. And I think that Weeza always tells the truth. And she will tell the truth. I say she will. She's a person that exists on film now. And, you know, as if she was alive. She isn't. But she will tell the truth when she confronts it. Now, in terms of Polly, Polly Wyeth is a character who is unable to reveal fully amount of the truth and is taken.
But she knows it. And all these women, one way or another, know a truth, and it's about the relationship to that truth.
Yeah.
And these stage things you've done. And I find that to be a really kind of interesting thing.
Well, we all just go through life, and it's the issue of how much you reveal. And there is a style of being in the world we live in now, which they call quote unquote reality shows, which of course are not, completely edited, quite phony, and all the rest of it. And that's supposed to be the truth? I don't think so. But even in regular life, there's discretion. And you don't tell everybody, there's white lies. But there's a trend now sort of in the air that if you just reveal everything and rip it off, you know, sort of the Arab Spring of life, that everything will be okay. And we've learned that you open that Pandora's box and some of it's okay, but a lot of crap happens to a lot of innocent people. And this microcosm in this play of Robbie's, that that sort of happens. There's collateral damage to both the secret keeping and the revelations. I think it's Stacy says, as Lyman, a lot of us go through life, I'm paraphrasing it, keeping secrets sometimes is not the worst thing to do. Mm. And that, you know, diplomacy, discretion is on one side, and tell-all is on the other end of the spectrum. And that's just, I think that's life. That's what we deal with on a daily, almost moment-to-moment basis.
Talking about truth with Stocker Channing. She starred with Stacey Keach and Judith Light and Elizabeth Marvel in John
and
Robin
Tommy
Bates.
Sadowski.
And yes, absolutely. Most of the original cast in John Robin Bates' play Other Desert Cities, which will resonate, of course, for our L.A. listeners. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com, speaking of California. But I just find that when you moved to stage after doing TV and film for a point in your career, it seemed like you were on kind of a quest to play these characters.
You know, basically, I look for good parts because, you know, I like to do stuff that has comedy involved. But one of my frustrations when I was working in, like, comedy stuff in Los Angeles, like sitcom stuff for a bunch of years, a long time ago, is that the style of that little art form is not particularly satisfying to me because I happen to like things that are difficult. I like things that are tricky. I love balancing the humor of a character with the sometimes tragedy, sometimes just pathos, whatever, because I think that resonates to an audience. So I try to look for something where I can throw in everything. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm trying to think back. I mean, maybe when I did House of Blue Leaves, you could say that was a farcical character, but I had thoughts in my mind about good old Buddy Flingus that kind of resonated to me. But that's probably as far as I've gone to that completely broad,
but even that character and some of these women that you played have an understanding of the weight of words. They almost never speak in a way that they're unconscious about. I mean, there's a deliberation.
Well, that's attributed to the playwright, not to me.
But, you're choosing the characters.
Well, I'm choosing to work with good people. I'm choosing good playwrights here. You know? I mean, really.
No, sure. But I guess you're attracted to these women for whom understanding the power of language is key. And that's something that you talk about these being great playwrights and great plays, of course. But still, these characters are women who are very precise. Even when they're keeping the truth at bay, they know they're doing it.
I think so. I mean, it's hard for me to analyze it from the outside, to be honest, because I just sort of play it as it lays. I take the next thing that's available to me to do. People have said in British, what is there a part you'd really like to play? Which is, by the way, one of the most ridiculous questions that you've ever asked somebody.
I'm going to scratch off the
list
right now.
You scratch it right off the list because it's like we have no idea what's around the corner. And as a friend of mine once said, he said, you know, with whom, for whom, when, and where, if we're talking about existing characters. And then as you move through life, there's certain characters you will never play. I will never play Juliet. A little old for that. But so you can't drive yourself crazy about the stuff not played. But the other thing is you wait to see what comes in the door and you read it. It's funny. I remember when they first sent me Other Desert Cities about 2 years ago. And I read it, and I read it out loud to myself. And because of my personal relationship of friendship and business, whatever, professional friendship with Robbie and Joe Mantello, the director, I gave it a lot of my attention, and I didn't think I could do it properly because Polly is somebody that is very different for me. And I don't just mean politically. I mean, she's older than I am. She's had life experiences I've never had. So I asked her to sit down in a room and just read it with other actors. And we did. And when you read the language out loud, something subterranean starts to happen. That is the transaction between the characters that you often can't see just reading a play on a page. And it starts, if it's good, it starts to lift, as I call it. And you want to go develop it. And that experience in that room of reading that play is so different from the experience of doing it now, 2 years later, on a Broadway stage. Because there's a transformative element when actors get together with material and directors direct them, and they become three-dimensional, they become kinetic, and it's very mysterious. And you sort of wonder, how did that playwright start on that page? Because on the page, it is flat. Unless you're doing a sitcom where it's laugh a line, laugh a line, laugh a line. And that's not what we're doing here. That doesn't interest me at all. I love it when audiences are laughing at something, and then they're saying, well, something else is going on. Something else is going on. And that's what makes really great live theater.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking about great live theater with my guest, Stocker Channing, nominated for yet another Tony for Other Desert Cities. I just love saying that title, actually. So I always feel like I'm about to say it wrong. You can hear the show also at KCRW.com. But as we're talking about this, and we've had many conversations about honesty in drama, and that is something that's that question about who's being honest and who is not, and awareness of that is something that also has happened a lot in things that you've done on stage.
Well, on this particular one, Other Desert Cities, I can say that's definitely in my mind, because there's a point in the show where, as she watches her family sort of deteriorating, and her son, who we used to call in rehearsal Switzerland, because he is a neutral guy and he's like the healthiest person, and she knows it, and I always felt that she loves him beyond belief, and her daughter is damaged and her other son is lost, but that he pleads with her in a very impassioned moment to forgive, quote-unquote, her daughter for writing this memoir and her sister. He says, you know, do it, because all that matters in life is when you're dying and you're going to be scared is what you have loved. And the irony is, at that moment, she loves this boy enormously. And the son was in tears and says, that's it, I can't do it anymore. All she says is, I can't. Then she says, I can't, not built for it. I know myself. And now I happen to know at that moment, I know why she can't. I know why she can't forgive her sister. I know why she can't not try to stop her daughter from publishing this memoir. I know that as Polly, but the audience doesn't know that. And she then pulls back and says, not built for it, because that's what she's created, is this facade of being the bad cop. She is as tough as nails, and which she kind of is, but she's been made tough, I think, by that 25 years of keeping this secret, because that's what life does to people. We are the accumulation of experience. And that little moment is so moving to me, because we would maybe all like to be slightly different from what we are right now, you know?
We don't think of her as being maternal until this moment is revealed.
Yeah.
And then we realize that there was a maternal impulse that she's probably still paying for.
The other thing is, there's a lot of projection on Polly from the audience. Sometimes, I've said to them, you know, all of these plays are written by children. They're not written by parents. And sometimes, you know, I don't even have children. But I say, you know, come on, give the mom a break. I mean, because you can feel, it's palpable. Because Polly, she's not physically abusive to children. She tells it, she is honest. She's direct, forthright. She's not belittling.
That's why that moment, though, at the end,
yeah.
Because she's been so, and that's why I said honest, she's been so almost bewilderingly honest.
Yeah.
That when this last thing, the big moment at the climax of the play happened, it evokes so many questions. And again, getting back to me, that relationship that these characters you all have, that you've played, all have to truth.
Well, you know, it's interesting as we sit here, that Eitan Pates thing has just been revealed. And I think about that man who may have murdered this child 36 years ago or something.
Yes, 1979.
I mean, the desire to tell is always curious to me, you know, why people confess. In Polly's case, she did supposedly a quote-unquote good thing. I don't know. But there is that desire to tell. And I always think her husband wants to get this burden off him. And she is so aware of the consequences of unburdening herself for another human being she loves that it is not a relief to her. It's something horrible to her to have to kick over this rock, if you will. But I'm fascinated by the desire to tell. That people want to confess, they want to confide, you know, what it does to people not to have that ability, just in life in general. And when you deal with a play about secrets, that has to be examined, you know, the desire to tell and the consequences of holding back and all that stuff in between.
What a good time to take a break. My guest is Stockard Channing. She's starring with Stacey Keach and Judith Light and two others in Other Desert Cities on Broadway. She's a Tony nominee for Best Actress. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Welcome back to The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. We're talking about secrets on stage with Stockard Channing. She's currently starring on Broadway right now in Other Desert Cities. But we've had so many conversations. I've known you about these kinds of things, these issues. Even I remember talking to you about West Wing and just there's mm-hmm. the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're right.
Similarity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I forgot about that. And when we go back to West Wing, it's true because Abigail was sitting on that huge secret because that whole thing that they stuck in there about, you know, that she had been her husband's doctor was hiding his MS, which was thrown in there about a month after it was on the air when I joined the show, Aaron and I had lunch, and he said, I'm thinking of making you a doctor. How do you feel about that? this is my second episode I was supposed to do. And he said, you know, I'm writing that POTUS has a cough. And I'm thinking maybe he has MS. I swear to God.
Really?
Yeah. And that's how it happened. And he threw in that dynamic that they were both sitting on this secret, that this couple, and also for her, eventually in the course of the show, that she was so jeopardized, you know, in terms of her being a doctor and losing her, you know, all that.
Basically, a violation of her Hippocratic Oath.
Exactly.
And yes.
Exactly. But the other secret sort of was that he had betrayed her in that.
He said he's only going to run for one term.
He said he wasn't going to run at all.
No, that's right.
He was going to be sort of the sacrificial lamb kind of thing. And then he got so popular that she, you know, had never signed on for this, and much less going for a second term. So that's another dynamic. Of course, that went on through 7 years or something. That's the longest play ever made or the longest movie. I don't know. But it's interesting. That's always, I think it's a great element in drama.
But I just thinking about that. I mean, after the show was over and I was with a friend, I said, isn't this like West Wing? And she goes, yes, exactly. That's exactly what it.
And it always is that secret that couples have. You know, that keep. Yeah, it's interesting. I never thought of the parallel till now, but you're right.
Because there's a kind of unspoken anger between the two of them. And that's also because, you know, they're guardians of this
secret.
Well,
it's a curious thing. We never have a conversation on stage, Stacey and I. And I say something and he makes a comment on it, or vice versa, which is kind of true in kind of marriages. But you don't see them have a private conversation and even in front of others. But there is a constant connection between them, which is totally intentional. We look at each other. We move to each other. You can sense it. It's a chemical connection. And what people don't realize is because it's not just that they've been married for 5 million years. It's because they share this secret. And they treat it in different ways. And in rehearsal, we talked about she is the enforcer. She's always been the enforcer. She knows she's the bad cop. You know, he is the good guy, and not unlike Abigail Bartlett, and she takes on the role of enforcer a little bit, but much more strong in this play. I mean, even when he talks about her going, you know, to the Republican ladies and saying, shame on you and all of that, the task to play this part is to be believable that you are the kind of woman who would have that affect on those ladies. And, you know, it's tough. And sometimes you just want to look at the audience and say, you know, I'm really a nice person.
And I'm not a Republican. Because clearly, I mean, the parallel has been made between your character and Stacey's and the Reagans.
Yeah, but these are people who came from a time when, you know, I, in my time, have voted for Republicans, and it would be very difficult to do that right now because of what has happened to that party.
But it used to be moderate
Republicans.
But
they are a product, given their age, given where they came from. They were once moderate Republicans. This is my theory, but because of what reveals, the way they had to play the party line so actively in the last 25 years, I myself think that she's not really that, or he is politically. It's about a social thing. It's about keeping this secret. But it's a generational thing. It's the world we live in now. I don't have to go into more details about how polarized our system is. But I am old enough to understand a time when that wasn't the case. You know, when I think probably Olympia Snow is, maybe Susan Collins is the last of that breed.
That's probably true. This is such a great conversation. It's a treatment. It's always good to have Stocker Channing here, even though she hasn't been here for 10 years. But hopefully we'll make up for that in the future. Her newest project is on Broadway right now, Other Desert Cities. It's The Treatment. You can also hear it at KCRW.com. But you're talking about that power dynamic between you and Stacey and that couple.
Right.
I think about how many times that's come into play in these other plays that you've done, too, where there are so many unspoken things. And sometimes,
certainly going back to Joe Egg, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then this sort of this bond because of this family condition or secret or thing they really can't say aloud, mm-hmm. and what that does. And it's in so many cases, these shows, it's made the guy kind of affable because it's his way of sort of dealing with the horrible aspect of this thing.
Well, yeah, I don't think this is intentional, but it is often true that in a marriage that people take, I said, the good cop, bad cop kind of role. I mean, even in parenting,
sure. You're
about that. I mean, in real life, that happens. You know, daddy's the one who says, oh, sure, let her do it. Or mommy is gnawing the inside of her cheek in frustration. But, you know, I think there is, it's rare to find, I mean, it's almost like horses in a carriage. They're kind of, they're loosely tethered to each other, so there's mobility. You know, you've got to have that range when you have two people or tied together. It's sort of, it's like, it's got to be a kinetic, three-dimensional, moving forward thing. And if they're just rigidly the same person, that doesn't usually work.
Sure.
So I think it reflects a truism in, you know, in society, in the world we live in. But you're right. I think in any marriage that's truthfully written, there's going to be that dynamic.
And again, I think that's something that separated your stage life from what you had done before when you were doing movies and TV. You found these things because, first of all, it gives you somebody to play with.
Yeah,
you know, it
yeah.
gives you somebody to work with. And also the way these shows can tend to work towards that denouement of revealing or having it slip out more, because that really it's never really actually been revealed in any of these things. It's the thing that just sort of gets out into the air.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with it once it's been exposed to the atmosphere. But the way these couples, that many of whom have been together for a very long time, by the way, too.
Yeah. It's interesting, and when I think back, because we did Joe X so long, many years ago, in that particular case, she destroys her marriage by holding on to her fantasy of hope for her child. But that's a young marriage. I mean, the child, I think, was about 8 or something. So that's a woman in her 30s, maybe something. And that's the end of a young marriage. I think as I get older, and I obviously play older, you know, people, or I am older, you know, the marriages get older, whatever, those kind of rings on the tree, you know, accumulate. And so the reality is very different. So an older marriage is very, I mean, even though we live in a time where people are sort of marching off into the sunset by themselves and leaving marriages that are of 25, 30 years, you know, fine. But that's another story. And also, it's more interesting to see the stuff that's bubbling under the surface. I think there's more dimension in a situation that's survived over years and has many, many facets rather than a brand new. I mean, that's the stuff of comedy, maybe, is like, you know, somebody 60 years old marching off into the unknown. I actually did a sitcom about it a couple years ago called Out of Practice.
Yes, so
and with Henry Winkler,
we were
both single people. And it was fine, but that's comedy. That's like brand new, la, la, la. It's almost farce. But when you get into real drama, unless, you know, it's totally boo-hoo time that you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm 55 or 65, whatever I am, and now I've left my husband, and now I'm in love with someone younger or someone older, and then it doesn't, and, you know, it's all very sad. But it's not really all that interesting unless something really interesting happens into that mix. You've got a really good writer. You have to go back to the writing.
We will. It's the treatment. This is Dr. Channing, her new show, done by a great writer, John Robin Bates's Other Desert Cities. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. But I guess what my real question is in getting through all this stuff is how much of an appetite you have for charting these emotional histories? Because even in Joe Egg, even though it's not as long as some of the other relationships, there's a history there.
Oh, yeah.
There's been time spent. And I wonder, as a philosophical person, how much pleasure you get from figuring out the ebbs and flows, the ups and downs, and these emotional lifelines these characters you played have.
Absolutely.
Had.
I love it. I love how they reveal themselves. They often reveal themselves even while you're playing them. You start hearing lines. You sort of go, you've been saying them maybe for 50 times, and you didn't quite get the full dimension of them, the little lobster meat that's right dug into the claw there. And it comes out, and suddenly you realize, oh, I know what I'm thinking here. And when you know what a character is thinking, when you open your mouth and say these lines, or you're listening to someone else, that's the great luxury of doing stuff for a very long time. And it's not a direct, necessarily, response. You could be suddenly thinking about the way we do in life. When something traumatic happens, you suddenly look at the wall and say, "That God, there's that paint. I got to repaint that wall." When you've just found out that someone's been in a terrible car accident. I mean, there's some weird thing that happens in real life. And when you can really approximate that oddness in a character on stage or whatever, that often helps in acting because it's not right on the nose. But that's an accumulation of moments like that. This sounds insane. I'm sure people have no idea what I'm talking about. But it sort of starts really paralleling actual reality.
But let me give you this context. We were talking about this just before we started, about the benefits of having a long run in something. And part of that's got to be that you get to know the material so well, you can live in it in a way mm-hmm. you can't when you only do it for a 3 or 4 month run. You've done this for how many performances now?
Tonight will be my 300th performance.
So at a certain point.
And you said, I can't believe you do that because I was so wrung out watching it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And people's afterwards, it's, you must be wrong, exhausted. It's it's so exhilarating because it's such a fantastic piece to do, and it's you touch all the colors, you know, and it is exhilarating, and it's also all every night we start at the beginning and we go to the end and we go through every step of the way. There's no shortcuts, and it's like a great workout. And it's a tribute to Robbie Bates that he's written such a piece that you can do a 300 performance and not be, you know, thinking about the grocery list sort of thing, or what am I going to have for dinner? And sometimes you sort of do, but then sometimes that's okay too.
I don't want to know what you were thinking the other night when I was there, but I will ask you this. At a certain point, with everything Robbie does, he likes to go through so many colorations in a way similar to what John Guare does. Having moments that are extremely farcical, almost like doors opening and closing, going in. And then that moment, very close to the climax, and then for both of them as writers, I think, where there's complete stillness as there's been this enormous shift. And it's that moment you think, well, what would I do in this moment? And what would be happening in this moment? And that's got to be the pleasure. And for you, in doing these things, too, you talk about the writing, but it's also there's a kind of a slipstream that happens with these writers that you tend to be attracted to.
Well, as I said, I think that's quality. That's great when you can resonate with an audience. I mean, this piece is an interesting structure because the end of this piece is the beginning for every one of those characters for their life afterwards. This play ends with this great stone being thrown in the water, and the ripples from that stone happen after this play is long over. So it's a curious structure that way. And you can feel an audience. They get so dead quiet. And they have been laughing their backsides off for hour and a half, hour and whatever it is. And before I come in the second act, I can hear gales of laughter. And I said, well, here it comes, kids. Here it comes. And this Polly comes in and she has a couple of laughs. But it's just the screw starts to tighten. And they think they know what's going to happen. And when Lyman starts telling that story, or we erupt, or whatever, I won't go into it anymore. I've got to bite my tongue. I have to keep my secret. You can hear a pin drop. It's great.
I think you've been in a number of plays that have those kind of
moments. I have. I've been really lucky. I've been very, very lucky. In terms of material that hasn't been done before that I can't access by watching or hearing about another performance of it, when it's new material, I have been unbelievably lucky. I mean, I didn't see a production of Joe Egg before I did it. But to me, Peter Nichols is really almost a contemporary playwright because of that. And he was so incredibly fresh at the time. You know, I mean, there's even in Hapgood. We'll go back to Hapgood, for God's sakes. And that end of Hapgood with that poignancy of...
And again, there's that
stillness. And that secret. The secret.
Yes.
That whole thing is about a secret.
You're making me want to see it again. We're out of time. Thank you so...
Oh,
it's so good
to
see you. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you. Great to see you.
My guest is Dr. Channing, a Tony nominee for Best Actress for the show, Other Desert Cities. I love saying that title. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios in New York is Noriko Okabe. The show is mixed by J.C. Swadek. It's edited by the producer, Jenny Radelet. It's oh so quiet here. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.